grateful for a moment of light relief. Just as Marie was starting to wonder whether this exercise was any use at all, Gary knocked on the door.
"This is the last of the list, sir, and Robbie asked me to tell you that we've picked up a very good photo of Stefan from the cleaning company. He's done some work on it, so it's now got the same full wavy hair as he had in the CCTV picture. He's circulating it to all forces and also the media."
"Good work. I suggest we flood the town with them. Shop windows, bus stops, anywhere you can find. I want everyone in Sultan Le Fen to know this man's face."
Gary nodded. "I'll see to it immediately, sir."
"Sir," Marie said, "I don't think I'm being too helpful here. Could I go and do something else? You and Laura have this exercise pretty well in hand between the two of you."
"I value your input, Marie, but okay, we'll fill you in when we're done."
"I was wondering if you'd mind if I went to see Sheila Simmons. We know she hasn't much time left, and I'd hate for her to find out about Ashcroft and Blake from somewhere other than us."
Jackman nodded. "I did want to go myself, but I can see it's not going to happen. Yes, Marie, you go." Marie escaped as fast as she dared, and once outside the office, heaved a sigh of relief. She couldn't tell Jackman this, but she was sure the only way they would know what Ashcroft had in mind was after he had brought it about. She didn't phone ahead. Sheila was going nowhere, and there would be someone looking after her. So she pulled on her riding gear and set off for Nettleby Oaks. Marie loved riding. Today the roads were clear and the weather good. Just what she needed to blow away the cobwebs from her overcrowded brain. Riding her bike relaxed her and made her feel alive. Though Harvey wasn't a flesh-and-blood loved one, she had put him on her list because she would be devastated if she lost her precious bike. She'd already lost one beautiful motorcycle through the actions of a crazed killer, and she had no intention of losing another. She pulled off her helmet and rang the doorbell. The door opened, and she saw a face she hadn't seen before peering suspiciously at her.
"Liam, so you do exist?"
She thrust her warrant card at him. "A word, if you please, and then I want to talk to your mother."
"Sod off."
She jammed her boot in the door and put a hand on his chest, pushing him backwards into the hall. "It wasn't a polite request, chum. You've been giving us the runaround for days. We can do this here and now, or I can get a car to pick you up and we take it into the Nick. Your choice." Liam threw her a poisonous look, turned and slouched into the lounge. She had known, the minute she saw him, that Liam wasn't their killer. But she reckoned he deserved a bit of arm-twisting for his refusal to be interviewed. Leaving her boots in the hall, Marie followed him inside.
"So, what made you decide to go against your mother's wishes and refuse to talk to us? Something to hide, have you? Something you don't want the rest of your family to know about?"
Yvette appeared in the doorway and gave Marie a knowing smile.
"I've got nothing to hide," Liam growled at her. "I just think Mum's wrong. Being so ill, she's not thinking straight. Why should we help you?"
"Because we are trying to get to the truth. And we're also trying to find a bloody dangerous psychotic killer. Any help, even yours, would be appreciated."
She narrowed her eyes.
"And your mother's a damn sight cleverer than you'll ever be, Sunshine."
Liam was silent. She reached into her jacket and pulled out a copy of Alistair Ashcroft's picture. "Do you recognize this man?" Liam looked at it and laughed.
"It's some kind of wind-up."
Marie felt a moment of confusion. Yvette looked over her brother's shoulder, and the recognition on her face too was instant.
"That's Alan. He's not in trouble, is he?"
"Sorry?
Alan who?"
Marie asked.
"He's our counsellor. He's been helping us for, 6 years or so. He's been amazing."
This wasn't going the way Marie had expected. Even Liam showed signs of warmth when his sister spoke about this man.
"He listens," he said. "I mean, really listens to us.
Doesn't give us any flannel either. He's a solid bloke.
Marie tried to assimilate what she'd just been told.
Alistair, as Alan,
had been counselling the whole Simmons family for over 6 years. This was massive. Maybe, just maybe, there would be a way to trace his lair.
How did you come to meet him? He was friends with two of our longer-standing supporters,
Yvette said.
Christian and Mark. Mark was worried about us, and the strain that the campaign was putting on the family, and he asked Alan to talk to us. We still see him occasionally. He's been a real tower of strength.
Yvette spoke so warmly of this man, this murderer. It made Marie feel oddly cold inside. Now Yvette was looking at her, frowning.
Why are you showing us a picture of him, Sergeant?
What to tell her?
We believe he can help us with our inquiries, Yvette. It's imperative we find him.
He's missing,
said Liam warily.
Yes. Have you seen him recently?
Liam shook his head. No, not for weeks.
What do you really know about him? And I assume the others you mentioned are Mark Courtney and Christian Ventnor.
Yvette nodded and sat down on the sofa next to Liam.
He had some connection to the church, didn't he, Liam?
Liam nodded. Yes, but he never preached at you. He just seemed to understand what you were going through.
I said church, but he wasn't a minister or anything like that.
Yvette was still frowning.
It was Mark that told us Alan worked with church aid groups, and he also had something to do with disturbed children in care.
Marie swallowed.
Excuse me for a moment. I have to ring this in.
She stood up, hurried into the hall and phoned Jackman.
Get someone to go and speak to Christian Ventnor, and also Mark Courtney. Tell them to ask about a counsellor they recommended to the Simmons family. Someone by the name of Alan. I don't have a surname. Jackman, Yvette and the elusive Liam have just fingered the photo of Alistair as this man they know as Alan. He's been infiltrating this house for over 6 years.
Marie returned to Yvette and Liam.
Sorry about that.
I suppose you wouldn't have an address for him, would you?
No. He called round here regularly, but we never went to see him,
Yvette said.
A phone number?
Yvette shook her head.
Sorry. We were grateful for the help he offered us, and it was all gratis, so we never tried to bother him in his private time.
Yvette stared at Marie, her eyes wide.
You seem very anxious to speak to him. There isn't a chance that he is...
She gasped.
Let's just say it's a matter of real urgency that we find him.
Liam looked anxiously at Yvette and, to Marie's surprise, took her hand and squeezed it.
Shit, sis. Looks like we cocked up, opening our hearts to the lovely Alan.
He looked at Marie. Or am I wrong?
No, Liam, but none of you could have known. This man is one of the best confidence tricksters we've ever come across.
Then the thought struck her. If Alistair was intent on manipulating love, love was in abundance here. Their love for Brendan had kept them going, kept them together for years. Surely one of the Simmons family would make a perfect victim. She must mention it to Jackman, and Laura too.
One last thing before I ask to see your mother. Did Alan look exactly like this when he came here?
She held up the picture again.
His hair was gelled back in a sleeker style, but other than that, yes, that's Alan.
Yvette looked to Liam, and he nodded. Yvette stood up.
Why did you come here today, Sergeant? I know you said to see Mother, but why?
Marie smiled gently.
Your mum doesn't have long, I know, and I have some news for her. It's something we would normally keep strictly to ourselves, but under the circumstances we wanted her to know before it's too late. She deserves to hear it.
Liam glanced at his sister and then Marie. Can we hear it too?
Any of the family that are here can listen to what I have to say, but you have to promise to keep it to yourselves until we say otherwise. This must not be leaked to the press. That might completely ruin our chances of catching the killer.
Yvette opened the door, and they climbed the stairs to Sheila's darkened room.
Jackman went in person to Mark Courtney's house, and found him in his home office typing, presumably yet more letters regarding Brendan's posthumous pardon. He showed Courtney the photo of Ashcroft.
Where did you meet him?
At a lecture, I believe. Yes, that's it. When I retired, I started working on a paper. I attended some lectures on the subject, and he was at one of them. We hit it off immediately, and we kept in touch. Interesting man. Had a wide knowledge of psychological theory.
Now why doesn't that surprise me, thought Jackman.
And you say he worked as a counsellor?
He specialised in depression in teenagers. His main interest was teen suicides. He'd done extensive studies, apparently.
A specialist in suicide.
Oh, perfect.
Did you see any proof of his qualifications, any diplomas, anything at all, really?
I never went to his home, Inspector. He always came here.
Jackman began to lose heart. He needed to know where Ashcroft lived.
And Christian Ventnor knew him too, is that right?
I introduced them.
Chris found him fascinating. He paused.
By the way, though I never went to Alan's place, I think my sister did.
Jackman perked up. Your sister?
Yes, Pip. She and Alan became quite friendly. I'm sure she said she visited him once or twice, for business reasons.
What sort of business? Asked Jackman.
You'd have to ask Pip. I know she became quite fond of him. Then he told her he was gay, but he did care for her as a friend. It was all rather sad, but they still remained pretty close.
Can you tell me where I can find Pip, please, sir?
Jackman half stood, ready to leave.
She lives next door. I'll give her a call.
He pulled the mobile from his pocket and phoned his sister.
Got a mo, Pip? Police are here. They want a word about Alan.
He ended the call.
On her way.
Jackman studied him.
Can I ask why the continued interest in the Brenda Simmons case? It's been years now, but you've become a central part. Maybe the central part of the campaign. What made you persist with it for so long?
Mark Courtney stared into space.
The honest truth? Sheila. That's why.
Sheila Simmons? You admire her stamina in keeping up the fight?
I do. But it's more than that. I'm in love with her. I've always loved her. Even way back at school. And I never looked at anyone else. Unfortunately, my friend Simmons had more charisma. And he won fair lady.
He sighed.
Now he's dead, and I do the best I can to look out for her.
She doesn't know, Inspector. And considering she doesn't have long left, I expect this conversation to remain between us, okay?
Jackman nodded. One big question answered. Before he could say more, Pip Courtney strode into the room.
Alan? Is he all right? He's not hurt or anything, is he?
She was a vivacious redhead. Her voice was rather high-pitched, and Jackman found it slightly irritating.
No, he's, missing. And we need to find him as a matter of some urgency. Do you have his address?
I did, but he moved about 2 months ago, and I haven't seen him or heard from him since. I've been quite worried. Now I'm even more so, if you say he's missing.
Your brother tells us that you had some business dealings with this gentleman. Isn't it odd that he should move without leaving you a forwarding address?
Our business dealings have been finalised, she said rather haughtily.
And what kind of business would that be?
She bit hard on her bottom lip.
Would you like me to leave you for a moment?
Mark asked his sister.
He turned a long-suffering smile on Jackman.
She's always played her cards close to her chest, my sister. I've learned to keep my nose out.
No, Mark, it's over now, so it doesn't matter anymore.
Pip Courtney gave a deep sigh.
Because of what he was. You know, the way he was.
Gay?
Prompted Jackman.
Yes, because of that, His father threw him out and the rest of his family were less than supportive. I really felt for him, poor man. How he must have suffered.
Jackman kept his expression impassive.
Anyway, she coughed, he had some properties, and he was anxious that his family shouldn't know about them. He was paranoid that something would happen to him and they would come swooping down like vultures and get hold of his estate.
Mark was leaning forward, clearly wondering what was coming next.
We worked out a way to fool them. Alan sold the properties. Then, when he found somewhere he liked, he gave me the money and I purchased it. As these were in my name, there was no way the family could touch them. For a small fee, I kept an eye on them.
Talked to the neighbours and the like.
I would say that Alan was renting. He was such a good tenant, and so on.
Keeping up appearances, murmured Jackman. And everything was legally documented. Should he need to sell or recoup his money?
Exactly. It was just a paper transaction. I never had any real claim on his houses.
How many were there?
3.
He's left them all.
Pip looked sad.
He, or rather, we, sold them not long ago. He said he wanted to travel and the properties would just be a burden, even if he let them out.
Jackman thought for a while.
You must have used a solicitor for the conveyancing.
Yes, Rotherham Keats. They're down one of the back alleys in Salton Town. It's a very small company, but Alan didn't want to use anyone his family might know.
Jackman scribbled down the name.
Could you give me Alan's surname, Miss Courtney? I suppose it wasn't Ashcroft, was it?
She looked mildly surprised. Yes, it was.
And I'd also like the names and addresses of those 3 properties, please.
Jackman added the information to his notes.
And you have no idea where he might be staying now?
He said he'd be in touch, but... Why exactly are you interested in him?
Suddenly she seemed doubtful.
We need to talk to him urgently about an ongoing case. So if you do hear from him, please say nothing about our talk, but phone me immediately.
He handed her his card. Thank you both for your time. Outside in his car, Jackman rang Aurak direct.
Jackman? Goodness. Well, this is the first time for everything, I guess. How can I help you, Detective Inspector?
In his mind's eye, Jackman saw her silvery eyes. If I give you 2 names, 3 addresses of recently sold properties, and a firm of solicitors, could you work your magic and find out if the man involved, who is really Alistair Ashcroft, has any other dealings with this particular law firm? What I need is a current address. He gave her the details.
I'll ring you back when I have answers,
Aurak said. Jackman ended the call and then contacted Robbie.
Any luck with seeing Ventnor?
Yes, sir, although he knows pretty well nothing about Ashcroft, other than some load of old tosh he's been fed. I reckon Ventnor was a bit enamoured with the enigmatic Ashcroft.
Courtney said much the same, although he used the word spellbound.
Wraps people around his little finger, doesn't he, sir?
Sadly, yes. Have you heard from Marie?
On her way back, sir. And she says to knock Liam off the list. He's kosher. A right little tosser, but kosher. Her words, not mine.
Jackman smiled.
I thought that might be the case, Robbie. Okay, back to base.
Chapter 30 Marie rode back to Salton, feeling that, for once, she had really made a difference to her life. Even if that life was drawing to an end. Several times, she had needed to lift her visor to wipe away her tears. Marie had told Sheila as much as she dared, and she had listened with shining eyes. By the time Marie left her, Sheila Simmons looked as if the weight of the world had been lifted from her shoulders. Yvette hugged Marie as if she had delivered a cheque for £1 million. Dale and Liam appeared to be on the verge of tears, and Kenny and Susie looked at each other and smiled in utter relief. Marie had made sure they understood that the recorded conversation could not be used in court, but she assured them that when this present murder investigation was brought to a close, She would do her best to see that Brendan's case was reopened, using the information they now had and new forensic techniques. She couldn't make a firm promise, but they had her word that she would try. Still smiling, Marie entered the CID room to be met by a sea of grave faces.
"Okay, what have I missed?"
Robbie spoke quietly.
"It's Jackman. He's had to go to his parents' home. His brother James never turned up for a work meeting. He's missing, Marie."
All her hope and elation faded. Marie looked across to Jackman's office and saw that the door was open. She hurried over and found Laura still staring at all the sheets of paper.
"Is it possible? Could Alistair have targeted James?"
Laura looked up at her.
"Oh, yes. In fact, very possible. It confirms what I was saying earlier about justice."
Marie sank into Jackman's chair and stared at Laura across the desk.
"Explain? I've been thinking about this man and his terrible history, all the things he witnessed, and what he has done himself. I've come to the conclusion that he could never hurt a child. Surely psychopaths lack all empathy, and wouldn't that extend to children too? He's not a textbook case, Marie. He wasn't born with a mental impairment. He's the result of what he suffered, and somewhere inside, there's still that little boy who craved love."
"But what about the boy's suffering when their mother died?" asked Marie.
"He knows people can overcome that kind of hurt. He did, after all. He might even believe that he is helping them to achieve greater inner strength through suffering and loss."
Laura took a breath.
"What I meant was, he couldn't physically injure another child. Which means, if my theory is correct, that Ryan and Miles are relatively safe." "But why James? He's been almost a shadow all along.
Jackman has done more for the children than James." Marie paused.
"Oh, of course."
Laura nodded.
"If Alistair is killing with the aim of restoring justice, then James is the perfect candidate. He's never been there for his boys in their hour of need. He puts work before his children. He is therefore guilty of neglect."
She puffed out her cheeks.
"Once again, Alistair is prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner," Marie groaned. "But where is he? Where has he taken James?" "That's the big problem. I don't think James has much time left. We heard that recording. Alistair has a short fuse and his anger is escalating. One wrong word from James, and that would be the end of him."
Marie sighed.
"Oh, those poor children. And poor Jackman," Laura said. "The task of finding this killer is resting squarely on his shoulders." "You really like him, don't you?"
Marie had blurted this out before she could stop herself. Laura smiled almost apologetically.
"Afraid so."
Marie grinned broadly.
"I think that's the best thing I've heard in years."
Laura looked at her through her eyelashes.
"I'm not treading on your toes, then."
Marie snorted.
"Me? No way. He's my boss, my friend, and I'd lay down my life for him. But anything more? No, Laura. The field is clear."
Laura shook her head.
"Not exactly. I don't think I'm the only one who cares about him."
Marie straightened up.
"Excuse me, I can't have this. Something going on that I don't know about. Who?" "Ella Jarvis," Laura said. "I was watching her when we went to talk to the boys."
"Really? Well, all I can say is I happen to be pretty good at people watching myself, and I'm dead certain Jackman feels the same about you. So I'd go for it if I were you." Before Laura could answer, Jackman's desk phone rang.
"DI Jackman's extension, DS Evans here, can I help you?"
Aurak sounded almost excited.
"He asked for a trace on properties purchased by Ashcroft, possibly under another name. I've discovered a small firm of solicitors that he's used, and found out that he has recently taken a long-term lease on a place. The solicitor wouldn't give me any details, other than a rather handy email address for his client.
I've accessed his inbox and found several documents regarding the lease. And the rest, as they say, is history. I have the address of the rented property right here. Thanking Orak profusely, Marie scribbled down the address. Sorry, Laura. We have a possible location for Ashcroft. I've got to get some men out there. She ran from the office, calling for Robbie and Max. Get uniform, and we might need a firearms unit. We may have just found Ashcroft, and we know he has a gun, so get out there fast. And you, Sarge? I'll liaise from here. Just keep me in the loop all the time, okay? Next, she ran upstairs to the superintendent, who immediately authorized the use of firearms officers.
Where is this place? Ruth asked.
A small farmhouse off the road to somewhere called Chapel Rise. I've just googled it. It's secluded and pretty remote.
You'll hear us coming. Ruth's face formed lines of worry. Nowhere to hide out there.
I've requested softly, softly. No blues and twos. We can't do any more than that.
Marie looked at the superintendent.
Should we tell Jackman?
No, immediately. He's doing his best to hold his family together. We'll ring when we know whether this place really is Ashcroft's bolt hole.
And whether his brother is there, added Marie,
leaving out the dead or alive part.
Back in the CID room, Laura asked her why she hadn't gone with the others.
Marie paused. Because I don't think he's there. I'm sure it's his temporary home, but don't ask me why. I just think he won't dirty his own backyard.
Marie's mobile rang.
Jackman. How are things? She asked.
As grim as you'd expect, but I'm coming back shortly. There's very little I can do from here, and there are several officers with the family.
Marie understood that. Okay, we'll see you soon, and drive carefully.
As she ended the call, she saw Laura's face.
He's on his way back, and before you ask, he sounds like shit.
Was that the boss? Gary approached, his face drawn with anxiety.
He'll be back soon. Gary, what's the story about James? What do we actually know?
As far as I can gather, James was working from home in the morning, and he left around lunchtime to go for a meeting. At 2:30, his secretary phoned to see if there was a problem, as he hadn't arrived. He never did.
Gary pulled a face. His phone was switched off, something he never does. Jackman's father drove the route to his office just to see if he'd broken down or had an accident, but zilch.
Did they check Raynham Lodge? Murray asked.
Gary nodded. Jackman got a crew out there straight away, but he wasn't there.
So he's not been missing for long, has he? Ashcroft likes his dramatic settings, as we know. He likes to stage his murder scenes carefully. It isn't his style to capture his victim and then just kill him. He would need his subject to be fully aware of what was happening and what the charges against them were, don't you think?
Marie turned to Laura. Laura nodded.
He needs them to be aware of how powerful he is and to admit their failures, how they have failed their loved ones. He wants them to admit that his accusations are justified.
So James could still be alive.
Gary looked into space, then jumped at the sound of Marie's mobile. Robbie sounded hyped up.
It's his place all right, Sarge. But he's not here. The firearms unit went in first, but there was no sign of anything untoward. No one's been held here. It's neat and tidy, nothing out of place. There's no gun either, or a motorcycle. Although there are bike tire tracks outside the property.
How about a car?
One vehicle, a Nissan, around the back.
Okay, Rob, seal it up. I'm going to need every scrap of paperwork, every document, every receipt, every letter, anything to get a handle on where his real home is or what he's planning. And Robbie, I want several uniforms there round the clock, just in case he comes back.
So you were right.
Laura looked impressed.
Nice one.
Marie walked over to a big map of the area pinned to the wall and looked at the position of Ashcroft's rented farmhouse. It was secluded, all right. 10 minutes' drive from several main roads. So where was he now? And how had he managed to kidnap James, if indeed that was what had happened? She looked around.
Laura?
Laura hurried over.
Any chance that James has had some kind of episode, you know, been overcome with grief and just taken himself off for a while? Possibly, if it all got too much for him. It does sound like they're under a kind of house arrest at the stables, doesn't it? He might have needed some time out.
And turn off your phone when you have little children and a whole family under threat, Gary interrupted. I doubt it.
If he's in turmoil, he might. He wouldn't necessarily be thinking straight, Laura said. We're thinking it's Ashcroft because we are waiting for his next move. But what if James has just cracked? Marie mused. Anyway, we still need to find him, no matter why he disappeared.
They waited for what seemed like an eternity, unsure of what to do next. Then one of the desk phones rang. Gary answered it.
Traffic have picked up James's Toyota on a link road to the Lincoln Avenue. It was parked in a lay-by, undamaged and locked.
When was this?
The sound of Jackman's voice made them all turn round.
A few minutes ago, sir, and the officer reckons it's been there for a while. Cold engine.
Gary put the receiver back.
CCTV on that stretch?
Jackman barked.
Only at the town intersection on the main road, and he didn't show up there. If he turned in from one of the side roads, there are no cameras for miles.
Gary looked at the scribbled memo.
However, an attendant in the petrol station close to the lay-by did notice a Toyota pull up to help another motorist who had broken down. The description fits James.
They must have CCTV. It's a bloody garage, isn't it?
Jackman sounded edgy.
Uniform are looking at it now, sir. They'll report in if they find anything.
Looks like that's how Ashcroft caught him. The old breakdown trick, Marie murmured. But, sir, we need to fill you in on one development that happened while you were out.
She told him about the rented farmhouse. Jackman nodded.
So, we've prevented him from returning to his lair. That's good. But where the hell is he now?
In the ensuing silence, Gary tactfully went off to make everyone a hot drink. Jackman went into his office and Laura followed. Marie was about to join them, but thought better of it. It was the worst of times, but she hoped that Jackman and Laura would get a chance for some happiness when all this was over. But what state were any of the Jackman family going to be in when the final curtain came down on this terrible case?
Sarge,
Gary hurried back into the room.
Uniform have just confirmed that the man on the garage CCTV, the one that James was assisting, fits the description of Alistair Ashcroft. I'm just going to break it to the boss.
Marie felt her heart sink. Okay, they had already decided that that was what had happened, but the positive confirmation made it real. She needed to think, and fast. She tried to imagine what she would do if she were Alistair Ashcroft. Where would she take James? She sank down in her chair and closed her eyes.
If I were Alistair Ashcroft.
Alistair Ashcroft looked thoughtfully at his victim, his prisoner on remand. The culprit, in custody, pending trial. Alistair Ashcroft had chosen D.I. Rowan Jackman to be his adversary, and he had found him to be a worthy opponent. He looked at the brother. He would never have chosen this man for anything. What he was doing to his sons was beneath contempt. He wondered what on earth the dear departed Sarah had seen in him. Ah, Sarah, he smiled to himself. She had been far stronger than he had expected, and had shown great courage. Few knew it, but she'd suffered from a morbid fear of crowds and high buildings. Ever since they were children, both she and her friend had avoided going to big cities. It had been fitting that they should end their lives in a place that terrified them. He saw again her face when she made her final leap to oblivion. He hoped never to forget it. James wasn't a pretty sight. He was slumped in a chair, his ties preventing him from sliding off. A trickle of saliva dribbled from the corner of his mouth,
and made a dark stain on his pale blue shirt. It wouldn't be long before he woke up, and then Alistair could proceed. He stood up and stretched. Certain of not being discovered, he was in no hurry. He had a few small adjustments to make to the scene, and then the trial would begin. Chapter 31. What if? Marie's eyes snapped open. She hurriedly pushed back her chair and made for Jackman's office.
Sir, this might be nothing, but I've had a thought.
Jackman and Laura looked up expectantly.
I don't want to send uniform barging in all guns blazing, but what if Ashcroft has taken James home, to Raynham Lodge?
Jackman frowned.
It is empty, isn't it? Uniform checked it earlier and no one was there, but he could have waited for them to leave, then gone inside. You could be right, Marie. And if Ashcroft is holding my brother there, he'll kill him if we race in mob-handed. I want to check this out myself. James's only chance is for me to try to talk to Ashcroft.
Laura looked horrified. You can't reason with a psychopath, Jackman. He plays by his own rules.
But I could buy us some time. Marie would be waiting in the wings. And if he is there, we bring in the heavy mob, but under the cover of darkness, on foot and silently.
It's too dangerous.
Laura looked ready to throw herself against the door to prevent him leaving.
We have to go, Laura.
Jackman reached out and Marie noticed him touch her arm gently.
We will be back, I promise you,
Jackman said.
Don't make promises you can't keep.
Laura's voice trembled.
We will be back.
The words rang out. Wishing she felt half as confident, Marie nodded. Outside the office, Jackman pulled her to one side.
I know this is not correct procedure. In fact, far from it. But I can't risk something happening to James because I've sent an armed squad in there. You know as well as I do, these things don't always go to plan.
He looked distraught, and Marie felt for him.
What if I tell Robbie and get him and an armed unit to tail us at a distance? If he hears from me, then he can send them in, as you said before, softly, softly.
She looked him in the eyes.
And don't try to keep me out of this. I know the risks, but I happen to agree with you. Let's do it your way.
Okay. Then talk to Rob, and let's get out of here. The more I think about it, the more I think you're right.
Jackman was about to throw her the car keys, but she held up her hand.
You drive, and I'll follow on my bike. You say Ashcroft is a biker, so if he decides to make a run for it, I'll stand a much better chance of keeping him in sight if I'm on two wheels.
Good point. You follow me. We'll park up before we get to Water Lane and approach Raynham Lodge on foot, okay?
She gave him a thumbs up, spoke to Robbie, then hurried to the locker room to get her gear. The Land Rover pulled over and disappeared into the gloom as the lights went off. She cut her engine and coasted in behind it. She pushed off her helmet and hung it over the handlebars. Raynham Lodge was a short walk away, over a bridge, and then up to the house itself.
The front of the house is in darkness, whispered Jackman, but I can see a glimmer of light coming from an upstairs window.
Marie scanned the dark, shadowy driveway.
I can't see a car, can you?
No, but he's had plenty of time to hide it. Or he could have brought James here, then taken the car back and returned on his motorcycle. After all, if he kills James, he won't be needing to chauffeur him anywhere afterwards, will he? Then he can make that fast getaway you were talking about. People might notice the make of a car, but very few can identify a motorcycle.
Jackman fished in his pocket.
Luckily, I always carry a spare key, just in case Ella or the boys need me.
They crept closer, keeping to the damp grass to one side of the gravel drive. They waited outside the front door and listened. Marie could hear nothing, but she was certain they were not alone.
She felt a tremor of nervous excitement. Get this right, and Alistair Ashcroft would soon be in custody. Get it wrong. Jackman slipped the key into the lock and turned it. Still no sound. They eased themselves into the hallway, and Jackman closed the door behind them with a faint click. He led the way to the bottom of the stairs. He had been right. There was a dim light coming from the far end of the landing. "That's the boys' playroom," Jackman whispered. "Some of the stairs squeak. Keep to the right-hand side." They inched their way up the staircase and into the corridor leading to the playroom. Now they could hear voices. Jackman held out his arm and brought them to a halt. He and Marie stood shoulder to shoulder and listened. Initially, Marie thought there were three people in the room. Then she realized that two of them were Alistair, his voice changing. One moment he sounded strong and commanding, the next, feeble and whining. "This is not good," she thought. Laura had said he could be unraveling. It was as if she were listening to a ventriloquist and his dummy. Jackman's jaw set firm. "He's losing it. He could kill James at any moment. Marie, go back outside and call Robbie. Get that squad down here. I'll buy us as much time as I can." The last thing Marie wanted to do was leave him with this madman. But they had agreed. She touched his arm, nodded, and slipped back down the corridor. It seemed to take forever to get downstairs and then outside, where thankfully her phone had a good signal. Robbie answered instantly. "He's here at Raynham Lodge, and he's got James. We need armed backup as arranged, silent approach, and the last part on foot, understand? We're not far away, Marie. Just stay outside and guide us in, okay?" She could hear the tremor in his voice. He was scared for her. "Sorry, Robbie. I need to be with Jackman." She ended the call. Before going back inside, she ran to where she had left her bike and pushed it to a spot much closer to the house. She wanted Harvey within easy reach. She concealed the motorbike behind a large bushy laurel, then ran back to the front door. With a glance to check it couldn't be seen, she took a deep breath and slipped back into the house. Jackman's blood ran cold. His brother's terrified voice was shrill through the closed door. Self-assured, dogmatic, and sometimes patronizing, James now sounded like a frightened animal. He had no strategy worked out, but Jackman recalled Laura's words. There would be no reasoning with this man. So what the hell? He burst through the door and came to a halt in a makeshift schoolroom. His brother cried out, "Rowan!" A hefty slap across his face made his head sluice sideways. Jackman made out two desks. He had bought them himself, ready for when the boys started doing homework. A brief glance revealed several chairs, all facing the front of the room, and Alistair had painted a blackboard on the plain wall. On it, in white marker pen, were the words, "I must not neglect my children." Ashcroft stood on an upturned crate that the boys had used to store toys in. James was tied to a chair within striking distance of Ashcroft, taking class. "Leave him alone, Alistair. You have to stop this." His unexpected entry had made Ashcroft angry. "How dare you? This is a private court, and this man is charged with neglecting his children. And I'm his defense." Ashcroft gave him a look of unalloyed malice. Then, suddenly, he smiled.
"Ah, I see. In that case, please take a seat."
Ashcroft now seemed amused. "I have to hand it to you, Inspector. I never thought you'd guess where I'd bring your brother. You are remarkably astute." Jackman remained where he was.
"Alistair, please. I'm going to ask you to let my brother go. You can take me instead."
Out of the corner of his eye, he saw James's eyes widen.
I mean it. You and me, Alistair. You don't need James. You took away the woman he loved with all his heart. Isn't that enough punishment? You made him like this. He loves his sons. He's grieving for his dead wife, and you were to blame, not him.
Do the children understand that they are being ignored and left alone at night with only a nanny because Daddy misses Mummy? Do they understand when nightmares claim them and their father is not there to comfort them because he's working late? How do they feel when he misses their big football match or their presentation at school? They still hurt, Jackman. They still feel it in here. Ashcroft thumped his chest. To be ignored, made to feel like you don't exist, that you are nothing. It's soul-destroying. No man should make his son suffer like that. You say I don't need James, but I do. Sorry, Jackman. It's your brother that needs to pay, not you.
The gun was stuck in the waistband of Ashcroft's trousers. With no way of getting hold of it, all Jackman could do was try and talk him down.
Why do you want to destroy my family?
Ashcroft laughed. What? It was your Sarah that destroyed my family. This trial is simply to right a wrong.
I don't want to hurt your family.
I don't care one iota about your family. I'm just here to see justice done.
The man who killed Lindsay was the one who destroyed your family, not Sarah.
Jackman tried to think.
Come on, Jackman. Reason isn't going to work.
Maybe he should try to provoke some physical reaction from Ashcroft. He was pretty sure he could get the upper hand in a fight, so long as the gun didn't come into play. Time to up the ante.
Do you know what I think?
Ashcroft narrowed his eyes.
I think you just love hurting. No, torturing and killing people. But you need an excuse. Something oh so high and mighty, some worthy cause. Otherwise you'd just be like any other low-life scumbag with half a brain roaming the streets with a knife in his hand. The eyes were mere slits now, and Jackman knew Ashcroft was fighting to control his rage.
Think what you want, but you're wrong. I'm not like anyone you've ever dealt with, Jackman.
No, Alistair. You're just another damaged kid whose mind couldn't take it. Just another psychopath to be hunted down and locked away. You're nothing special, Alistair.
He shrugged.
Sorry.
Ashcroft clenched and unclenched his hands, his knuckles white.
You'll regret this, Jackman. I'll make you eat those words.
He snatched the gun from his waistband, snapped back the safety catch, pointed it at James's head, and... Ashcroft screamed. The sound of the gun echoed around the room. It took Jackman a moment to realize that Marie had burst into the room and flung a cast-iron frying pan at Ashcroft. It had hit his arm, knocking the gun from his hand, and the shot had gone wild. Before Jackman could grab him, Ashcroft snatched up the gun and lunged at Marie. Jackman called upon his rugby days and hurled himself across the room in a flying tackle. His shoulder made contact with Ashcroft, making him stumble. But as he did, Ashcroft caught Marie a punishing blow to the ribs. Jackman heard her groan and go down. Then the gun swung round towards him again, this time at point-blank range. A second deafening shot rang out, but Marie had managed to jam her boot hard against Ashcroft's calf, dead-legging him, and Jackman felt the shot tear into his upper arm.
"Sir? Jackman?"
Marie flung herself down alongside him, gasping for air.
"It's okay. It's okay, just my arm. He saved my life."
He looked around frantically.
"Where is he?"
Marie didn't answer. Instead, she hauled herself up and staggered through the door.
"Phone Robbie,"
she yelled back.
"I'm going after Ashcroft."
Outside, she heard the roar of an engine and paused to listen.
"Yamaha R6, she whispered to herself. "Fast, but it all comes down to who was riding it."
Clasping her bruised ribs, she sprinted to where Harvey waited for her. She pulled on her helmet and in seconds was heading for the only way out, over the bridge. As she banked sharply into the lane, Ashcroft's rear light now in her sights, she saw a stream of fast-moving cars heading towards her.
"The cavalry," she muttered. "Too late for this particular race."
Ashcroft blasted past the police cars, with Marie right on his tail. For a fleeting second, as she flew past, she thought she saw Robbie Melton's ghost-white face.
"Sorry, Robbie," she murmured.
She knew the road they were on, hopefully better than Ashcroft did. It had a long, straight stretch that ran for miles, and then it got tricky as it headed out over the fens. There the road began to wind into a series of sharp, tight bends. They were scary in daylight. At night, well, if you overcooked a corner on a fast bike, heaven help you. Ashcroft was riding well, but she detected a slight hesitation when he took the corners. The problem was, where was he going? Should she let him reach his destination or try to cut short this hair-raising ride? After a mile at high speed, she knew she was the better rider, but how to use it to her advantage? Marie tried to visualize the road. She knew it widened just ahead, and then gave way to a gentle bend, followed by a narrow stretch with a wall one side and a dike the other. She drew in a breath and closed the gap between them. The Yamaha was handling well, but she knew it was no match for Harvey, so long as she kept a cool head. Offering up a prayer to her Bill, asking him to keep her safe, she eased down on the accelerator. She tailgated him down the wide stretch of road, then, just as he leaned into the corner, she pulled out and cut in, braking as she did. Her rear wheel nicked his front tire, and Ashcroft spun out of control. Marie went into a controlled skid, vaguely aware that his bike was spinning like a top on the tarmac. Then it crashed into the wall. As it did so, a piece of fairing tore off and flew across the road like a javelin, jamming into Harvey's front forks and sending her beloved bike into a cartwheel. It happened in slow motion. Air all around her. Flying. Then she hit the ground and skidded on her leathers to where Ashcroft was trying to extricate himself from the wreckage of his bike. At the same moment, each of them fastened their eyes on the gun lying in the road. They were both injured. Marie wondered who was stronger. What did they call her in the mess room? The Amazon? Damn bloody right. She knew her leg was bad, but she dragged herself towards the gun, which seemed to shimmer on the asphalt. She saw Ashcroft, too, blood flowing from an arm that hung limp against his side. But he was on his feet. He leaned forward to grab the weapon. Marie summoned her strength and used her good leg to kick it out of reach. She heard the splash as it landed in the dike. Now he was standing over her, his face a mask of pain and rage.
"This isn't over," he gasped. "I'll let you live, but only to give Jackman my message. Tell him I'm a patient man, but he would do well to keep looking over his shoulder. One day I'll come for him."
Ashcroft drew back his foot and kicked her bruised ribs hard. Just before she lost consciousness, she saw his dark shadow move away. He meant what he said. He would be back. Epilogue. 2 months later. Robbie looked around his home and liked what he saw. Now he could really call it at home. It had taken Max about 10 minutes to tell him what it needed. Then he brought in Rosie to add her thoughts, and in another 2 weeks the transformation was complete. The thing he liked best was the far wall of the big open-plan living area, in front of his modern dining table and chairs. Max had hung a painting of a beautiful harbour scene, with high cliffs, a calm sea and colourful boats. Along with new drapes, bright cushions, and some strategically placed architecturally dramatic potted plants in striking containers, his minimalistic, sterile hotel room had taken on real character. He glanced at the massive station clock on the kitchen wall, another new acquisition. His friends would be arriving any minute. The team had wanted to celebrate Max and Rosie's recent marriage, but because of what had happened, no one felt it appropriate to go and get hammered down at the local. So he had suggested coming to his apartment for an informal get-together. Robbie took two bottles of champagne from the fridge and thought back over the last 2 months. It had been a strange time, full of intense emotion and sadness. Alistair Ashcroft had disappeared into thin air, but he'd cast a dark shadow over all their lives, and Robbie suspected that shadow would never go until Ashcroft was found and incarcerated. Ashcroft's evil presence had had the effect of bringing to the fore those things that really mattered in their lives, and for the first time in a long while, Robbie had seen things clearly. He now knew that he had put Marie Evans, like Stella North, on a pedestal and worshipped her. Now she was simply a dear friend and colleague. Having realized this, he had been able to move on with his life. He and Ella Jarvis had started dating. In just a short time of getting to know each other, she had confessed to having felt the same way about Jackman. She had been vulnerable and had looked to Jackman to be her tower of strength, but it had never been love. Robbie wasn't quite sure if it was love now, but whatever it was, they were happy together. Ella had decided that she would stay on with the children until Raynham Lodge was sold. James had accepted his parents' offer for them to move back into the family home where the boys would have their granny and grandpa, and their new pony, and hopefully a better life. Then Ella would be able to move on, and the direction she had decided to take was back into forensics, and Rory had welcomed the decision with open arms. Apparently the biggest surprise to her had been the radical change in James Jackman. Hearing his brother offer to take his place at the hands of the killer had caused a profound change in him, and as soon as he was recovered, he took extended leave of absence from the business and became a father again. Marie and Gary arrived first. She still walked with a limp, but the surgeons had given a good prognosis, and she was already scouring the internet for a successor for the irreparably damaged Harvey. "Wow," she exclaimed. "Robbie Melton, what a fantastic place." Robbie flushed with pride. Stella's hotel room was no more. Marie and Gary were soon followed by Rory and the others, and by the time Robbie had uncovered the buffet food and handed out the drinks, the flat was full of the sound of chattering voices. Robbie stood back for a moment and watched them. They were all relaxed and enjoying the celebration, but something had changed in them. Their encounter with Ashcroft had left a scar. No one laughed quite as loudly or for as long as they used to. The banter was less animated. Smiles faded quicker. Ashcroft moved among them, the uninvited guest who spoiled the feast. Robbie turned to his boss.
"Jackman, sir? Like to propose a toast?"
Jackman, who had been sitting close to Laura on the couch, stood up and raised his glass.
"First, thank you, Robbie, for allowing us into your beautiful home. And it's come as a bit of a surprise, I must say. We all thought you lived in some bedsit tucked away down a salt and back street, not this magnificent apartment." Everyone laughed. Robbie smiled and nodded at Max and Rosie. "Now, for the reason why we're all here. We have come to wish our dear friends, Max and Rosie, a wonderful life together with their little one. May the path you walk together, even if sometimes it's steep or rough, have a wonderful view from the top. To Rosie and Max." They all raised their glasses, and the room rang with cheers. When the noise died down, Jackman remained standing.
"If I may," he looked around, "I'm not going to spoil this lovely evening that Robbie has kindly arranged, but I can think of no better time, as we're all here together, to tell you something that I feel is very important." Robbie frowned. This sounded serious, and for a moment he was scared that Jackman was going to publicly acknowledge the elephant in the room. If anything was going to spoil the celebration, surely it would be that.
As you all know, if the jungle drums are working as efficiently as usual, Laura and I have been going out together for almost 2 months.
And about bloody time,
Marie called out.
Hear, hear, echoed Rory. You're far too good-looking to be a bachelor.
Everyone laughed, and Jackman pulled a face at them. The thing is, this should be the happiest of times, but I haven't allowed it to be, and for that I want to apologize to Laura. He gently laid his hand on her shoulder. And I want to promise her something. In fact, I want to promise you all something. Robbie watched, and having felt anxious about what his boss might be about to say, now felt a kind of excited anticipation.
The fact is, I've been eaten up with guilt about the way I handled our last case. I failed to bring an evil man to justice. But even worse than that, I've allowed that failure to blight everything from that moment on. It's been like a cancer eating away. And I've seen the way you have all been caught up in this terrible negativity. But no more. There were murmurs of dissent. No one blamed Jackman for what had happened. No, please, listen. Tonight I'm going to tell you all that Alistair Ashcroft is no longer going to creep amongst us like a dark, unspoken-of wraith. He will no longer poison our minds with his insidious whisperings. Every time we choose to mention him in hushed tones, he wins. His eyes became hard. And that man is not going to win. Tonight we put him back into the category where he belongs. He's a twisted and cold-blooded killer. A psychopath that has no place roaming free, and we, my friends, are going to put him away. Electricity coursed through the room. Backs straightened and eyes lit up. This is my promise. I will not let my feelings or my guilt affect any of you again. We're going to become the fully functioning dynamic team we always have been. We're going to be first-class detectives again, and this will give us our lives back. Oh, he hurt us. Hell yeah. But he won't do it again. We won't sit and wait for our patient killer to decide what happens next. We go after him, and we take him down. It was as if someone had injected something powerful into the room. The apathy that had clung to them seemed to fall away, and a new resolution was born. Marie raised her glass. We are with you, sir, all the way. To Jackman, and catching that sick psycho. For the second time, a cheer went up. From that moment, the party started and Robbie relaxed. With a contented sigh, he sat down next to Ella and took her hand. She smiled at him. You did well, kid. This evening was just what we needed. Robbie sipped his champagne. There was more than just a marriage to celebrate tonight. There was a new beginning for them all. Okay, Alistair Ashcroft was still out there somewhere, but now, instead of feeling like he was hunting them, the tables had been turned, and once again, they were the hunters. He raised his glass and gave a silent toast. We're coming for you, Ashcroft. Just you wait and see.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Guilty Ones, written by Joy Ellis and performed by Richard Armitage. Copyright by Joy Ellis, 2018. Production copyright 2018 by Audible Limited. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.